So again, good morning, everyone. Before I get into the Dharma talk for this morning, I just want to spend a moment just talking about what's called practice. And many people ask me, when I have interviews with them or otherwise, how can I deepen my practice? Well, there are many ways in terms of deepening, but in terms of just becoming better at, there's really only one answer, and that's practice more. I think we all know that. You know, if we want to get better at something, we have to practice it more. That's how we get better, whether it's a musical talent or whether it's a profession or whether it's a hobby or whether it's a skill. Be a better carpenter, be a better potter, be a better gardener, be a better whatever. Well, the more we do it, we'll get better at it. And then, of course, if we if there's someone who is mentoring us or supervising our practice, like a teacher, that's also very helpful. And I say that because I just want to again remind the community that there has been an effort since the pandemic began to offer support to people to deepen their practice. We now have meditation every morning from 7 to 8. Some people stay on the whole time, some can only stay on part of the time. But again, many people have told me, both new people how helpful, but also from more experienced people who have never really consistently developed a strong morning practice, how helpful that's been to them. So I encourage us to take advantage of these supportive activities. Nothing lasts forever. We don't know how long we're going to be offering them. So now's the time. And then in the evening, which is more a different kind of practice. Mornings are more for meditative practice, concentration, mindfulness. But like on Monday nights, we have a small presentation, but mostly a discussion of the mindfulness trainings. So much can be accomplished by purifying our karma through right thought, right action, right speech. And so this is an opportunity on Monday nights for us to deepen our practice of the trainings and precepts. Tuesday night, we practice devoted to loving kindness and compassion. If there's anybody on here who says, I don't need that, well, I bow to you and maybe you should be leading it. But for the rest of us, always, it is the complement to our meditative practice. It is the complement to our ethical practice. It is the complement to our wisdom practice. It is what connects us to human beings. It shows us how to connect with human beings and non-human beings. friendship is a word, but there are qualities, love, kindness, caring, compassion, wanting to, which involves more than empathy. It also involves the act of desire to be of benefit to others. This is the best energy to connect us to family, to friends, to society. And so that's Tuesday night. And then Thursday night is devoted to concentration. Many people say, I wish I had more concentration in my meditative practice. So again, Thursday night, we offer training and support in that. So again, I'm just making you aware that it's here. The time is now. So for anyone who feels that they could use the help and support and guidance, please take advantage of it. And it's also during this time of the pandemic when many of us are more isolated from each other, even though it's virtual. It is a way for us as a community to continue to practice together. Now, some people have said, I do it, Fred, but people say, well, I have Zoom fatigue. You know, that's a new term. Many people, are working now, and working from home and on Zoom and many other things. This is how we relate. Well, I have a solution to that. Don't look at the screen. nobody's telling you have to look at the screen. You could just be there and listen and participate. So, but what I really want to talk about today is the Buddha's enlightenment. Last Tuesday, in various Buddhist countries and tradition, they celebrate major events of the Buddha's life at different times. But in the sort of the Mahayana tradition of at least I know Japan and Korea and China, the Buddha's enlightenment is celebrated on December 8th, which was last Tuesday. So I really want to talk about that, because that really is at the heart of Buddha's practice. It's interesting. Many religions celebrate the birth date and the death date of their founders for obvious reasons. But in Buddhism, the most important date that is celebrated is the date of the Buddha's enlightenment. So I want to talk about the Buddha's enlightenment and why it is at the center of Buddhism. And there is no real true Buddhism without this awareness of enlightenment. Because the whole stream of Buddhist teachings going back to the Buddha and then continuing through all kinds of teachers and masters for 2,600 years plus, all comes from his enlightenment. Something that happened within his own body-mind. So, I think most of us know the general outline of the Buddha's life, how he was born to, at his time, to ease and pleasure, and how in his late 20s he had various kinds of existential experiences where he encountered that human bodies get sick, that human bodies age, that human bodies die, and everything is left and lost. And all of a sudden, he could no longer take joy in his temporary pleasures of the body and the senses, and in his possessions and in his relationships, knowing that it was sort of ultimately all for naught. So he left all that and engaged in, like many of us, he engaged in a search. He went to all the major teachers of his time and mastered many different meditative systems, but still never felt the liberation that he was seeking. It was always temporary to the experience, but the consistent liberation he did not find. And so finally, he thought, since attachment to the body and the senses and the pleasures are the key impediment here, then I will follow the path of asceticism and basically, by sort of starving, torturing, denying the body, what's usually called ascetic practices. And that way I will liberate myself from my suffering, from my attachments. And we know he did that for a significant amount of years. He had, I think, five or six buddies, who fellow yogis who practiced with him. And all it did was bring him to exhaustion, actually near death. And then he had this very strange experience. Not strange, but he had an experience where all of a sudden he remembered when he was a teenager and he had been attending, I think it was a plowing festival, sort of when everything was plowed up, and I guess his family and the priests and everything would go out into the fields and bless, the fields. It was very hot, and he had sat under a tree, and he was just kind of looking at what was going on, all the people and the rituals and the plows, drawn by oxen going through the fields, plowing things up, and he could see animals, little rodents, mice, and other kinds of animals and insects, being disturbed and running, and some being killed, and there was this whole, it was life, planting and, festival. And he was reflecting deeply on that. And he went into samadhi, which is, he went into a deeper place within himself, let's say, a deeper place within his mind, underneath all that activity. And in that moment, he felt incredible oneness and peace, with everything. And there he was, following this ascetic path, and he remembered this incident, and he realized, I had that incident when I was in the full bloom of my youth and I had everything, so all of a sudden he realized that the path he was following to liberation, was not in what he was doing in this ascetic path. But he remembered this great experience he had had, just as a normal person in good health and everything. So he decided that he would start eating again, which of course caused his fellow ascetics to desert him. He decided to eat and cultivate himself. And, there are various things in the story, but basically, he arrived in Bodh Gaya, what's now called Bodh Gaya, and he found, because the Bodhi tree, a kind of ficus religiosa that is very sacred in India, quite large. We actually have an offspring here in our garden. He took his seat under there, and he made the vow that he would not leave that seat until he had resolved, attained enlightenment, really understood the true nature of who and what he was. So he sat. And the interesting thing, he didn't have many of us want a faultless meditation, no thoughts, no nothing. He didn't have that in the beginning. He was trying to have that, and he was having it. He was doing deep meditation, mindfulness, but then he came under attack. He came under attack by Mara. Mara is the force of delusion, sort of like in Buddhism, Hinduism, sort of like the devil. It's like the force of self, the force of egoism. And so Mara showed up, and first he unleashed his beautiful daughters to try to seduce by their beauty and by their song, all that to pull the Buddha Shakyamuni out of his meditation. So this is the world of desire. Everybody know the world of desire. We want things. We want pleasure. We need things. How much of us, our equanimity and is disturbed by desire. But anyhow, the Buddha just sat. He was not. He could see through the whole charade of seeking short-term pleasure, and of the disturbances of desire. So when that didn't work, Mara sent his most wrathful soldiers, and they came to the Buddha and they threatened him and they yelled at him and they actually shot arrows at him, right? So this is fear. You see another, fear, anxiety, you know. Buddha, actually in the iconography, the paintings, what you see these arrows coming toward the Buddha, and as they get into his aura, they become flowers. You know, what is the antidote to hate and anger? It's love. So the Buddha just did his loving kindness, compassion for all these angry, wrathful, and he was undisturbed in his meditation. Then, please, for those of you who have this, please listen very carefully. Then he unleashed his secret weapon, Mara did, to unsettle the Buddha, which was doubt. And so, you know, first Mara tried this kind of soft seduction thing to kind of get the Buddha off his seat. Then he tried this angry, fearful, scaring him off his seat. And when none of that worked, he said, I have the one now. And so he very nicely says to the Buddha, Buddha, you know, sort of like, who do you think you are that you can become a fully enlightened Buddha? You know, I mean, you know, you're just Siddhartha. You know, you 6 years ago you were running around in a little palace. I mean, you know, you're not special. You know, you think you have the capacity to become fully awakened and to be of benefit to all beings? Who are you kidding? Nowhere do you have that capacity. And so it is said the Buddha, sitting very peacefully, all he did was he took his hand and just like this Buddha here, this is the Buddha in that pose. He came out of his meditation and he reached down and he touched the earth. He let the earth speak for him. And what the earth said was that there is not a square inch of land on the earth where this being in his past lifetimes has not sacrificed himself for other beings. And these are enumerated in the Jataka tales, which are the tales of the Buddha's past lives, many of them in animal form, all kinds of human forms. But it's very interesting. The Buddha basically let the earth bear, it's called the bearing the witness. The earth bore witness that he is ready. He can do it. He has done all the preliminaries that are the foundation for this final awakening. And so Mara and his daughter left. And then it is said that during that night, we'll call it December 8th, the Buddha went through a series of deepening experiences, which gave him what are called three essential knowledges. The first knowledge that he attained, what's called the first watch of the night, he saw his whole pattern of lifetimes. He could see in every life that he had lived, sort of who he was, what he did, and what his actions were, and how these contributed to the next lifetime, and these contributed to the next lifetime. And then he could see all of that in all human beings. So which means he now had sort of complete ability to see this unfolding of people's lives. And in the second watch, he understood more deeply what is called karma. He understand that the mechanism that he had observed of this endless unfolding of human beings' life, lifetime after lifetime, lifetime. It's sort of like us, you know, even if you don't believe in past lives, it's like us, you know, year after year, decade after decade, month after month, week after week. It's almost as if you could go back and actually see from your birth the whole unfolding of your life. How this led to that, and that led to that, and that. And then in the second watch, he could really understand more deeply the kind of psychological state that was causing this unfolding. He understood his own karma, and he understood the karma of everybody, right? And then in the third watch, he really understood the whole way that based on ignorance of the way things really are, of one's true nature, he could see how the whole pattern in every being develops into suffering rather than happiness, develops into delusion rather than nirvana. So he had that profound insight that he really understood the nature of human experience and how not understanding at a fundamental level how things really are, human beings are led astray. As Shantideva says, seeking happiness, all they do is create more misery for themselves. And then finally, in the fourth watch, the Buddha had his complete breakthrough, his complete enlightenment. In the Zen tradition, it is said that he had been meditating quite deeply and he looked up and he saw the morning star there in the sky. And at that moment, sort of everything broke open. And the quote is, he said, "Wonder of wonders, all beings are Buddhas, endowed with wisdom and virtue. Only their delusions prevent them from attesting to it." So that's sort of in the Mahayana tradition. In the traditional Pali, he's you know, we can only take their word that this is what he said, even he told people afterwards. In the Pali, in the more traditional, it says, "I wandered through the rounds of countless births, seeking, but not finding the builder of this house. Sorrowful indeed is birth again and again. O house builder, you have now been seen. You shall build the house no longer. All your rafters have been broken, your ridgepole shattered. My mind has attained to unconditional freedom. Achieved is the end of craving." Buddhism begins with this. Buddhism does not begin with the Buddha's teaching. The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Three Marks of Existence, you know, right up through the heart, you know, the Prajnaparamita, all the teachings and practices. No, Buddhism begins right here. "I wandered through the rounds of countless births." Everyone who's listening, we have wandered through it. Every day we wander through it. Every day we are born and die 1,000 times. Right? Days, hours, minutes, weeks, years, decades, you know how old we are. Yeah, we have just been wandering up and down, back and forth, happy, unhappy, getting what we want, not getting what we want, being liked, being disliked, loving, not loving, right? Gaining, losing. Endlessly we wander in this life. These are our endless births and death, our endless counting. But lost in this, we have not known our true self. Right? But he says, today, he has discovered who actually created this house of delusion. He's seen the self, and he's realized that it doesn't have any real existence at all, and he has penetrated beyond that. And so it's sort of like having got to the root of it. He says, it's now all broken down. O house builder, you have now been seen. You shall build the house no longer. All your rafters have been broken, your ridgepole shattered. My mind has attained to unconditional freedom. This is, you know, we live in the house of self. We live in the house of conceptualization, of thought, right? Which is filtering and conditioning all our experiences. We never look outside the house of self, the house of I, me, my, the house of Fred, or whatever our name is. This is the house we live in. We don't realize this house has been fashioned by our delusions, by our ignorance, by not really knowing who and what we are. So in the Buddha, in his deep meditation, he went in and he saw the very structure of how self is created in his mind, and he went deeper or through or opened or in many ways to talk about it. And he had this, not only did he break it up, but he experienced profoundly who and what he was. And, you know, I'll come back to the Zen one. All wonder of wonders. It kind of emphasizes the other side of the Buddha's enlightenment. Not only what was destroyed, but what was experienced, what was gained. He said, wonder of wonders. All beings are Buddhas, endowed with wisdom and virtue. Please, everyone, hear this, what the Buddha said. Right? All beings are Buddhas, which means that you're a Buddha. I'm a Buddha. Our loved ones are Buddhas. The people we agree with and the people we disagree with are all Buddhas. Our friends and enemies, they're all Buddhas. What does that mean? That means they all, no matter how they're running around or how they're thinking, intrinsically, they have this true Buddha nature, their true mind, their true awareness. It's right here, right? Endowed, as he said, with all wisdom and virtue. All good qualities are here. So this is profound. And I think, again, it's one of those things we often skip over and say, oh, yeah, everyone has the Buddha nature. We bow to the Buddha. But we don't reflect deeply. Do I believe this? Don't just kind of go, oh, yeah, okay, that's great to know. Yeah, Buddha, yeah, that's the essence of Buddhism. We all have the Buddha nature. Turn the page. No, this is radical. This is profound. This is something that none of us really know because we don't experience it. We live in the conditioned self. We live in the world of birth and death and coming and going and pain and loss and da-da-da and da-da-da. We don't live in the truth of our being, do we? And it is said that, that without a Buddha appearing in this world, that truth doesn't become manifest. And beings just continue, right? It's like people, you know, living in some area where they have no water, you know, and they're all just endlessly thirsty all the time, and they're killing each other over who gets the water, you know, and all that. And all of a sudden somebody comes along and says, you know, all you have to dig down is about 40 feet, you know. There's water down there, enough water for everybody. Everybody can have water. You can think how transformative that would be for that society to know, oh, because they all think they're thirsty, needy, you know, people. Their whole life is based around, you know, getting water and holding on to water and getting, making sure nobody else gets their water, and, you know. And all of a sudden, because no, there's enough water for everybody. You just got to dig down about 40 or 50 or 60 feet. So this is very profound. We don't know this. We didn't grow up hearing about this. We didn't grow up around people who manifested this, you see. So even though we might intellectually be able to get it, we don't really get it. Because if we got it, it's quite profound. It's unsettling. It really can, you know, change how we look at ourselves and we look at human beings when we understand our potential. And as he said, our potential is right here. All human beings already have it, which is also very significant in Buddhism. We already have it. There's nothing we need to do other than what? Well, his second. So he says, wonder of wonder, all beings are Buddhas endowed with wisdom and virtue. Only their delusions prevent them from attesting to it. So this is the second part. This is the answer. You know, well, you know, if I'm a Buddha, if I have this true nature, how come I don't know it? If I have this wholesome, pure, you know, all beings of myself are all the same. I mean, anyhow, these are just words. You know, how come I don't experience that? You know, that's a good question. You know, that's not my experience. I'm a Buddha. I have enough trouble being a decent Fred than being Buddha. So how could, you know, because our delusions, our attachments, our aversions, our wrong thinking, our self-centeredness, all the things we talk about, our lack of insight, our lack of real intelligence about this life, this is what's preventing us from seeing it. Only that. So obviously then the you know, what's to be done is fairly obvious. In the same way with what I said about, you know, the person shows up who tells them how to, you know, that there's water down there, you know, and all you gotta do is dig down, you know, that's the work you gotta do. I mean, for anybody who, you know, that's like, oh, okay, now I get it. That's what I gotta do. Oh. In terms of Buddhism, yeah, I have this true perfect nature. It's all here. It's my true mind. It's my true awareness. It's natural. It's my natural mind. And it's endowed with wisdom and understanding and all the good qualities that we seek. It's already here. Unfortunately, what? Because I'm so caught up. It's like dirty glasses, because my glasses are so dirty. I can't see what's right in front of me, right? Because the windows are so dirty, I can't see the beauty outside, you see. Oh, I get it, then I need to just what? I need to clean my glasses. I need to clean the windows. Or another analogy could be, there's no difference between pure spring water and, there's no difference between pure water that comes out of the tap, and there's no different than water that comes out of the toilet bowl. And you might go, no, 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 no. right? I'll drink the water out of the tap. I'm not going to drink the water coming out of the toilet bowl, right? And somebody might say, but they're all water, right? I mean, they all have the same properties of water, right? Why not? Well, because one is dirty. But if you know how to purify water, which means you know how to take the contaminants out of the water, then you can drink the water. Because in essence, the water that comes out of the tap and the water in the toilet bowl are the same water. But one, because of causing conditions, has become dirty and the other hasn't yet. Is that clear? So this mind of ours that may, you know, people may go, oh, I have a really dirty mind. I mean, not in the classical sense, but I mean, like, you know, you know, it means it's like, you know, it's neurotic, it's got all kinds of issues, all kinds of afflictions, you know, all kinds of greed and anger and fear and, you know, well, you know, I mean, it's just like you look in your mind, you go, whoo. No, none of that is real or solid. Those are just, that's just the impediments, that's just the contaminants. And through the process of purification, the process of practice, our minds become purified. When our minds become purified, we can see our true nature. Why can we see our true nature? We don't have to do anything. It's already here. Right? You see? See, I don't have to, if my glasses are dirty and everybody looks, you know, if everybody looks obscured, I don't have to go around, you know, dealing with each person, you know, trying to get the obscurations off of them, right? That would be a lot of work, and it would be totally unsuccessful. All I got to do is clean my own glasses. Then I can see purely. All I need to do is clean the windows, right? So, you know, from that point of view, practice is about that, and all the various practices we do are all in the service of this purification of our hearts and minds, so they can reflect naturally the truth of our being, our Buddha nature, our awakened nature. Again, it's not as if we, it's not something outside us. It's not something we have to get. It's not something we have to create. It's nothing we have to fabricate. It's none of that. This is you know, the great gift of the Buddha's enlightenment, that he realized this himself, and then he didn't, you know, he didn't keep the secret to himself, even though he was tempted to. I mean, we have to know that in the literature it says he was very tempted to. You know why? Because he knew us. He knew us so well. He said, oh, these sentient beings, you know, they're so caught up in their stuff. They're so caught up in their issues. They're so caught up in their gain and loss and, you know, and egos and, you know, always wanting this and not wanting them. He said, you know, they are so worldly. Right? Worldly meaning so involved and over-attached, and all they see is the comings and goings of the world. They're not going to be interested in this. I mean, he was not going to teach. Not because he didn't want to help beings, but he just thought, you know, they're just, they're too busy, right? Like us, we're just too busy. Right? They already have a full schedule. And in the evening, you know, they like to relax, right? Watch a movie, you know, who's going to want to purify their mind, you know, and you can be watching a movie, you know, it's having fun, right? Yeah. So, I mean, he knew us, and this was 2,600 years ago. And yet, he had a couple of experiences that convinced him, is probably the case for most human beings. He was convinced that there were some people who would be receptive to his realization and then his teaching, right? And then therefore, if, you know, from that, you know, he went out He went out, he first went and found the five ascetics that he had been practicing with, and he began teaching. And then for another 50 years or so, he just taught. But he taught what? He taught what he had learned from his own experience, from his own realization, from his own deep reflection on life. So, you know, if you look at this process, you know, it's a real template for all of us. I mean, it doesn't mean the template is, you know, we all pack up our bags tomorrow and sell everything and say goodbye to all our relationships and go off. But it's a template for our minds and the actions of our body, speech, and mind. You know, knowing that the freedom from suffering that I seek, the awakening to all that is wholesome and good in me and is available, and answering our desire to help beings who suffer. Why do they suffer? Because fundamentally they don't know the truth of who and what they are. Right? So, you know, we all have the capacity in terms of our life of beginning to mobilize some energy in the direction of our own awakening. We're all different. We're all in different places in our life. We're all of different situations. And we all have maybe different aspirations. But I think what unites all of us is we are, you know, we don't want to suffer. And we don't want to bring suffering to others, which means we'd like to be happy and we'd like to bring happiness to others. Right? And to know that all of us have that capacity within us already, and all we need to do is kind of reorient ourselves into what's important in life and where we put our energy in life and what we cultivate in real life, and really understanding, like the Buddha did, what is the source of our suffering. We don't reflect deep enough. I was talking to somebody, a member, the other day, and I don't know, they were just talking about, you know, lately their mind has just been obsessed or about some getting some things. It's just been disturbing their mind, again, ruminating. They need this or need that or they want this. And, you know, what I said to them was, you know, you could let go of those thoughts and all that, but that's not the answer. You need to reflect. And so I asked them, you know, have you ever in the past wanted things? Really wanted things. So much that you really were very focused and disturbed. And he said, yes. Okay. Did you act on them? Yes. Did you get what you want? Yes. Did it make you happy? Did it give you peace of mind? No. Okay, reflect on that. Reflect on that and go through all those times that you have wanted. You know, and ask yourself, why do I really want this? Is it really because it's a need, or is it because I think if I get it, it will make me happy? It will make me feel good. You know, and we need to reflect deeply on it, just like the Buddha, to come to the conclusion, yeah, I don't want to suffer. I want to be happy. I'm weary of all this endless, you know, circling about. But I want an answer that's not just temporary. I want a solution that really gives me what I want. You know, and so it's only through that kind of deep reflection like the Buddha did on his life. And I think many of us are guilty that we don't spend enough time at this reflective piece, right? Many of us, it's just up here. It's an intellectual kind of understanding, but it's not a deep reflection in, you know, deeply within our own mind, using our own experience. And the, like the Buddha did, he used his own experience. You know, he himself wasn't experiencing sickness, old age, and death. He saw it in others. And when he saw it, he went, because his, you know, in the story, his family, his parents had been told at his birth, you know, in those days, they called it, had an astrologer come. And they said, you know, you got an exceptional son here. There are two ways open to him. He can either be a great leader of human, you know, of people, you know, and his family was sort of in a Maya kingdom. He can be a great ruler, or he will renounce it all and become a Buddha. Of course, his parents, there was no choice, right? You know, no, they want him to be the ruler, you see. They didn't want him to renounce the world and become an ascetic, a yogi. So they had sheltered him his whole life, sheltered him. But finally, he had these experiences where he saw sickness and aging and death. And, you know, when he found out what it was and that it comes to all beings, and that all his activities, all his body, his wealth, his fun, all adds up to nothing because he has to leave it all. He reflected deeply on the implications of that. And is that true? You know, so we can observe, you know, we can observe life around us. We can observe, we have so many things. We have history. We can learn from history. All human beings' attempts through changing the external conditions to create happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Remember that one? We're Americans. That was what? 1700s? 1800? I mean, you know, centuries and centuries ago. We've been at this one for hundreds of years. This human experiment. Are human beings happier? Happy? You know, we have to ask ourselves, look deeply into why is that? We have to look deeply into our own life and all the things we've done and go, it doesn't mean we haven't done and had experiences that have brought us happiness. But once that happiness passes, what are we returned to? What is the state of our mind? This is why meditation is so important. Reflection is, you know, what is the true state of my mind? When all the activity ceases, when I'm not doing anything. That's why for many people, you know, meditation is not comfortable. Because when we meditate, we have to touch our minds and hearts as they really are. Because that's the place where transformation occurs. You know, it's when the music stops and we're just standing or sitting and we just feel ourselves. We you know, this is the truth of what's really going on inside me. Is there a deep inner peace in me? Do I really feel this natural connection to all beings in life? Do I truly care about the happiness and the end of suffering of everyone? Is that really what's in my heart and mind? You know, when I look at my life, is that what I'm doing? You see, so we need to... You know, be like the Buddha and reflect and reflect and reflect very personally, very deeply. Because to do meditative practices and to do compassion practices without this deep reflection, there's no energy to hold these practices together. So this personal reflection, which again, we're all capable of. We all have decent minds. You don't need a PhD in Buddhism. You don't need a master's degree in Buddhism. You don't even need a bachelor's degree in Buddhism. You really don't have to know anything about Buddhism to be willing just to reflect on your own experience and the experience of others. What's your truth when you looked honestly at life? And these fundamental issues of suffering and happiness. You know, what does it mean to me to know that, you know, everything's impermanent? Everybody I'm involved in, every endeavor I'm involved in, you know, my own body, it's all just endlessly unfolding according to endless causes and conditions. And at some point, they're all going to leave me or I'm going to leave them. Just a matter of what comes first. I mean, that's just the way it is, isn't it? So the Buddha's enlightenment, which is this incredible breakthrough, this incredible awakening, came. You see, that's understanding cause and effect. We see how, oh yeah, you know, can we be like the Buddha and see not just past lifetimes, but just in this lifetime? Can we see the movement of our life? From one experience to another experience to another experience, and also understand sort of the kind of energies, positive, negatives that are within us that are kind of driving us along in this life. Right? Can we see that all and understand that all? And understand fundamentally what's causing it? You see, what's causing it? And what's causing it for, you know, people I love, the people I care about, my friends, my neighbors, my extended family, you know, out to all beings. So again, we all have this capacity, you know, some are deeper thinker than others, you know, we don't have, it doesn't have to go on, but we have to come to grips with our life and the life, you know, of this, you know, the life of a human being, the brief little manifestation of a human being in this world. And what am I going to use this vehicle, this body mind that I've been given, these opportunities I've been given now? What am I going to use it for? See, it's a very personal question, isn't it? What am I going to really use this body, mind, for? Now that I know there are these two paths in life, one path just leads to a continuation of delusion and suffering, and one path leads to the enlightenment, my own enlightenment, and the enlightenment, hopefully, of everyone that I can contribute to. You know, which road am I going to take in this life? And again, it has nothing to do with, you know, the work I do or where I live, or it's not geographic. It's really about my mind and the energies. So the Buddha's enlightenment, very significant. And the reason it is celebrated, once a year in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha's enlightenment is celebrated, is because it is at the heart of Buddhism. It's where it all comes from. It's that knowing that we're all intrinsically Buddhas. It's all here. That's why, you know, it's out of that understanding that the Buddha created his path. We don't have to go anywhere. We don't have to get anything. We don't have to create anything. We actually have to stop doing all that. and begin to cultivate, you know, so to speak, our own garden, our own mind. You know, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, we need to, you know, pull out all the weeds. We need to gather all the garbage, compost it, turn it into healthy soil, and very consciously go about growing things that are, you know, flowers and, you know, fruits and vegetables, you know. We need to start growing things within our own mind that, you know, can nourish ourselves and nourish other people. You know, we all know about feeding the hungry, don't we? But you know, there's a deeper hunger among all beings. And that is the hunger for wanting to be free of suffering, wanting to be truly happy. You know, that's a wonderful thing that we need to can learn ourselves and then learn how to nourish others with that. So let me stop now. I'll take any questions. Maggie's in the back. So please, there's a chat function at the bottom. Just chat in your questions. And if anybody in the hall has anything, so take a moment. Any questions? About this, what's been shared this morning. Yeah, I think it's kind of obvious, but and also any questions about how to then take what's been shared today and put it into practice in our lives? Yes, Maggie.
Just a question on your reference of where is the quote that you're reading from, The Wonder of Wonders?
Which quote was that? Oh, Wonder of Wonders. I don't know. You know, I think my years, early years at the Zen Center with Roshi Philip Kaplow, I think he used to say that when we would celebrate. In the Japanese Zen tradition, December 8th is like, especially because Zen puts such emphasis on meditation and awakening. So sort of, you know, it's the Buddha's enlightenment is very stressed. So the it's called Rohatsu. It's that December 8th, and usually in Zen temples and monasteries, there would be a you know, all year long there'd be these sesshins or retreats, but usually the one that came around December 8th would be sort of it would have a kind of ascetic quality to it. To kind of honor that the Buddha, you know, made a great effort. So usually we used to do all the rounds. I forget if they were 35, they'd be 45-minute rounds. And instead of ending at 9:30, we'd sit to maybe 10 or 10:30. And then I think on the last night, everybody was encouraged to stay up all night and meditate, sort of to, you know, emulate the Buddha. So I think that's where I got that quote from, Wonder of Wonders. But I'm sure if you Google it, you will find Wonder of Wonders, all beings are Buddhas. The Buddha's awakening. Yes.
What do you mean when you say we are born and die 1,000 deaths every day?
Well, again, if you, you know, So when I say born, we think of physical, you see. It's not like we become babies. And when we think of death, we think of something, you know, like an ending, right? A physical ending. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about birth and death in just, if you think, see, birth and death physically is just a designation in time, right? You know, something is born, for us, we'd say, well, you know, I was born, this baby comes and then it grows and then it dies. I mean, that's the experience of the physical body. But we're giving birth to mind states, we're giving birth to thoughts, we're giving birth to experience constantly. And all those experiences, all those feeling states, all those mind states, none of them are permanent. Nobody stays in a permanent mind state. Nobody stays in a permanent thought. So all day long, we're what? Birth and death, birth and death, birth, coming into being, disappearing. Mind states. All relationships, all experience. This experience is now. We are participating in birth and death, right? We begin. And they'll come to an end. This is the life of birth and death. We're constantly, this is our life. That's why to know your true nature not only frees you from you know, over attachment to this, but it also frees you from the over attachment to that, you know, seemingly very important birth and death, which is really just the same. We just don't see the other side. We don't see where, you know, where things come from. We don't see that this is an endless stream of becoming, from being born and dying. Every relationship you've ever gone into, right? Every new job you've ever had, what? It begins with a birth, it ends with a death. But, you know, but it's not a physical death. It's because in Buddhism, actually, at death, there is no dying of the mind. Okay, so that's what I mean. Yes, Maggie.
If we feel inspired by this vision shared this morning, what are some practical everyday first steps to be implementing it? Take time to journal and reflect, for example?
Yeah, so again, you know, I think I've, you know, about a month ago, I think I gave a retreat, which really emphasized reflection, peace. Then I believe in the Dharma talk afterwards, I shared a lot about that. Yeah, and it's really struck me, even though that I've talked about, you know, hear the teachings, reflect on the teachings, practice the teachings, that really Americans, we pay lip service to that. And I think that is sort of held us back. And it struck me that that's really, you know, there's a reason the Buddha said that. You know, don't be in a hurry. When you hear the teachings, stop. Make sure you understand what's being said to you, what you're, you know, in those days it was all oral, now it's also reading. Make sure you understand it. And then, you know, look at, do you, you know, then once you understand it, you then test it through your own logic, through your own analytical powers, but most importantly, test it through your experience in life. Very honestly, openly, you know, is this teaching really, you know, congruent with my own experience in life? And again, we have this ability, I mean, again, the, you know, in the Buddhist time, you can only kind of see what was going on in your town or village, but I mean, we have, you know, we can observe the whole world. And we have recorded history. I mean, it's, you know, and so, you know, it's much vaster, right? So there's, it's, in a way, it's, you know, it can be even more obvious to see these truths. Yeah, so we reflect until we have realization. Realization means it becomes real to me. It's not just intellectual, it's real. I get it. Then when we get it, you see, then, see, usually, traditionally, you do this first before you even begin the path. This is where you begin, right? And only when you become convinced, right, you know, of the truth of the Buddha's teachings, and you become convinced, you know, that you need a path in life, you know, to get you where you want to go, do you then begin to practice? Now, again, we, you know, because of the nature of our world today, we don't do it that way, right? So we, because we have such access to the teachings and it's so easy to practice, you know, like we can just start practicing. I mean, I'm always meeting new members who go, oh, I've been reading the Buddha's teachings and meditating for decades, but never kind of systematically or never consistently or on or off, you know. And that's because that piece was missing. When you have that piece, then you have some energy and consistency to want to, you know, persist in this path. And again, it's good to read the, you know, life of the Buddha, good to read the life of the masters and men and women today and throughout history who again, and it's not like we're going to all have the enlightenment of the Buddha, right? So let's be clear, we're not talking about that. But we're talking about what the Buddha said, that everyone has the capacity of having some degree of realization of their true nature. Why? Because it's right here. And we know in the Buddhist time, I mean, there were, illiterate sweepers, you know, the lowest class in there, you know, the sweepers who came to him, and the Buddha gave him practice and he had his own enlightenment experience of his true nature. We know that Agunamala, you know, this serial killer, you know, bad, bad karma, heavy duty karma, you know, nobody in this room has had a karma like Angulimala, right? He became a disciple of the Buddha and purified his mind stream and had realization. These stories are in the Buddhist tradition. You know, we should read these things if we, again, remember, who did Mara send last? You know, if he couldn't do it through seduction and lust and desire, if he couldn't do it through fear and hatred and anger, he said, I got my secret weapon. It's the most insidious. I'll send him doubt. You know, we either doubt the teaching, doubt the truth of the Buddhist statement, or we doubt our own capacity. You know, that's considered just the voice of Mara. You know, the voice of delusion, the voice that's always trying to pull you away. You know, it's all, you know, it's always short-term oriented. And we all know that voice, don't we? We all know that voice. It's all, you know, all the things all day long that pull us away. That's the voice of Mara. Right? And again, like with the Buddha, he shows up in many different, he's got many voices. He can generate many kind of illusory things to pull us away. Even things that sound really good. But they take us, again, it depends whether, you know, we understand deeply, what the Buddha's teachings are about. And we really believe that we have the capability in this life of really being free. Again, as I said many times, you know, that is not in our psychological tradition. Our psychological tradition in this country is therapeutic. If I can just not feel as bad and feel a little better, that's enough for me. And of course, I understand that, but that's not what the Buddha's teaching's about. He's saying there's a cause. And that cause can be uprooted. Good. So good. So happy Buddha's Enlightenment Day. Big celebration. We celebrate, in America, we celebrate July 4th, our own Freedom Day, so to speak, other Freedom Days, but the Buddha's Enlightenment is a Freedom Day for all humanity. So good. Thank you, everyone. We'll stop here.